KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Stock markets are plunging after President Trump laid out his biggest menu of tariffs yet. We speak with Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin about the move. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Israeli troops are taking over more land in Gaza. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says he's cutting up the Gaza Strip to pressure Hamas to return hostages. Aid groups say food is running out. Also, a new children's book by the author of Heavy, Kiese Lehman, celebrates the joy of feeling safe while exploring the world and the history of U.S. efforts to project soft power. It is Wednesday, April 3rd. On this day in 1948, President Truman signed the Marshall Plan to help European economies recover after World War II. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. allies are very upset with President Trump's new worldwide tariffs. The minimum level is 10%, but some countries will face steeper levies. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports they include U.S. allies in Asia.
South Korea's acting president Han Duck-soo lamented the 26% tariffs on his country and instructed officials to draw up plans to support affected industries and negotiate with the U.S. to minimize the tariff's impact. Japan's Nikkei stock index slumped to an eight-month low on news of the tariffs. Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba called the 24% tariffs on his country extremely regrettable and said he'd raise the issue with President Trump in person if necessary. He noted that Japan has been the biggest foreign investor in the U.S. since 2019. But Japan's trade minister told his U.S. counterpart that the tariffs would make it harder for Japan to invest in the U.S. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
The U.S. Senate voted against Trump's 25% tariffs on Canada yesterday. Four Republicans joined all Democrats and independents to rebuke Trump. But the non-binding resolution is symbolic. The House is not expected to take up the measure. News reports say automaker Stellantis says it will temporarily lay off 900 U.S. auto workers. The reports say the company is citing tariffs on foreign autos. Stellantis will also apparently close plants in Canada and Mexico for 2 weeks. Powerful storms and tornadoes are sweeping parts of the South and Midwest this morning. One person has been killed in Missouri. Two more people died in Tennessee. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Nina Cardona reports Tennessee has been hard hit.
The storm line triggered dozens of overlapping tornado and flash flood warnings throughout the night and across hundreds of miles of Tennessee. The National Weather Service fielded reports of downed trees and damaged homes, barns and businesses, and potential tornadoes in multiple communities. Large hail pummeled the region, and numerous school districts are closed for the day. Flooding remains a major concern through the weekend with significant rainfall projections. For NPR News, I'm Nina Cardona in Nashville.
NPR has learned that tech company Amazon has placed a bid to acquire video sharing app TikTok. Saturday is the deadline set by President Trump for TikTok to be sold away from its Chinese owner. But NPR's Bobby Allen explains a coalition of U.S. companies led by Oracle may have the edge.
First, Oracle already operates almost all of TikTok's cloud, so Oracle systems are, you know, already supporting the app. Secondly, Oracle has experience with high-level national security data. For instance, Oracle does cloud computer work for parts of the government, including the CIA. And finally, Oracle is run by billionaire Trump supporter Larry Ellison, and he has been setting the stage for this deal for years.
NPR's Bobby Allen reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow was down nearly 1,600 points. It's NPR. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is meeting with other NATO foreign ministers today in Brussels. U.S. allies are worried President Trump wants to withdraw from the military alliance. Rubio is dismissing that as, quote, hysteria. He says the U.S. is as active in NATO as it's ever been. New York City's embattled mayor says he'll run for re-election as an independent candidate. He'll skip the fiercely competitive Democratic primary. NPR's Brian Mann reports the move comes one day after a federal judge agreed to dismiss criminal charges against Adams.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams was charged last year with federal bribery, campaign finance, and conspiracy offenses. After Adams signaled support for President Trump, the Justice Department moved to suspend those charges. Instead, Judge Dale Ho yesterday canceled the case entirely. Now Adams, who denies any wrongdoing, says that legal fight dragged on so long it prevented him from spending time campaigning.
I will forego the Democratic primary for mayor and appeal directly to all New Yorkers as an independent candidate in the general election.
This means Adams will avoid running against former Governor Andrew Cuomo in the June 24th Democratic primary. The two could still face off in the general election in November. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
Two baby eagles that have gained fame on the internet have also gained new names. School children east of Los Angeles have voted to call them Sunny and Gizmo. The eaglets are nesting with their parents in Big Bear Valley. On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 1,586 points. The NASDAQ is down 5.5%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we're going to speak with Republican Senator Ron Johnson about how the Trump administration's tariffs could affect his home state of Wisconsin, which is one of the U.S.'s manufacturing powerhouses.
First, let's explain those tariff plans. They're designed to limit imports and encourage domestic manufacturing. Starting this weekend, Trump plans to charge a minimum 10% tax on virtually all foreign goods coming into the U.S., with imports from dozens of countries facing much higher levies. Early reaction to the president's move has been mostly negative. The stock market fell sharply, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average down around 1,500 points, or 3.5%. The European Union has threatened countermeasures, and other U.S. trading partners are expecting to retaliate with tariffs of their own on U.S. exports. Speaking in the White House Rose Garden yesterday, Trump said the tariffs would help spark a rebirth of American industry.
We're going to produce the cars and ships, chips, airplanes, minerals, and medicines that we need right here in America. The pharmaceutical companies are going to become roaring back. They're coming roaring back. They're all coming back to our country, because if they don't, they got a big tax to pay.
NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley, joins us now to break this down. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Lila.
All right. So, you know, President Trump promised high tariffs throughout the campaign. So is anyone actually surprised by this move?
I think they're surprised by the magnitude. Okay. For example, we're talking about a 20% tax on goods coming in from the European Union, much higher than the U.S. charges today. In other ways, though, this is not surprising. Despite the United States' wealth and power, Trump has been complaining for decades that this country is being taken advantage of, and he's determined to fight back with tariffs, even as financial markets have been flashing red, saying, don't do it. Now, Canada and Mexico, two of our biggest trading partners, are being spared these additional tariffs for now. But Trump is slapping stiff new taxes on imports from economies around the world, even for products we cannot produce in the U.S., like the coffee and banana you might be having for breakfast this morning.
Oh, wow. So how did the White House decide who pays what?
Trump calls these reciprocal tariffs, saying they're simply designed to match the trade barriers that other countries impose on U.S. exports.
That means they do it to us and we do it to them. Very simple. Can't get any simpler than that.
But the White House later acknowledged it would be too hard to calculate the actual trade barriers from every other country, so they just picked an arbitrary number they thought would be high enough to chip away at each country's trade surplus with the U.S.
Okay.
And the result is a huge tariff increase, a 24% tax on imports from Japan, a 34% tax on imports from China, in addition to the 20% tariffs that were already in place. Now, other countries might absorb some of that cost, but a big part will be paid by businesses and consumers here in the U.S.
So let's talk about that. What's the potential economic effect of that?
Economists say it will likely mean higher prices and slower growth. Consumers are nervous, so are exporters. Tim Fiore conducts a monthly survey of factory managers for the Institute for Supply Management. He says they're already bracing for retaliation.
Here it comes, and we're already seeing that. We have manufacturers in the U.S. already feeling that experience. So the retaliatory tariffs are going to be really ugly. I mean, it's just going to kill demand.
Domestic manufacturers are supposed to be the beneficiaries of this trade war, but factory orders, output, employment were all down last month in anticipation.
And what about international fallout?
This is an enormous gamble. The U.S. launched a similar worldwide trade war back in the 1930s. It did not end well. The notorious Smoot-Hawley tariffs are widely considered to have worsened the Great Depression. And economists say Trump's new import taxes are even more draconian than those almost a century ago.
NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
So let's get some perspective now from someone who serves on the Senate Budget and Finance Committees. I want to mention he's also on the Subcommittee on International Trade, Customs, and Global Competitiveness. That's Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
So you've called tariffs a double-edged sword. Are you confident the sword is going to cut in the direction of the benefits and not the risks?
I have my concerns. I think the previous report was largely accurate. I would add that we obviously have a problem in this country. We have offshored many vital manufacturing of whether it's pharmaceuticals, whether it's the high-end semiconductors. There are all kinds of different things that we do need to manufacture here in the United States, just for national security. So trade is an incredibly complex issue. Hard to say exactly how this all ends. You know, this is something President Trump has believed for decades. He is absolutely dedicated to it. I think it's a reasonably high risk. It's a very bold move. He'll either reap the rewards or suffer the consequences.
Hmm. As we heard in Scott Horsley's reporting, a survey from the Institute for Supply Management this week showed tariffs dragging on manufacturing. That's the very sector that import taxes are supposed to help. Now, 19% of Wisconsin's workers are employed in manufacturing. That's nearly double the national average. So what are you concerned about? What could be the impact on your state?
Well, it certainly could make those manufacturers less competitive when they export. At the same time, I'm hearing from manufacturers that are not happy with the trade barriers imposed on them as they try and export already. So, as I said, international trade is an incredibly complex issue. Now, I'm, at my core, a free but fair trader, and that's been the problem. We have not been engaged in fair trade. We haven't been treated fairly by many of our trading partners, and this is trying to level the playing field in a very complex environment.
I think you met with the president yesterday. Is that correct?
We did. He was obviously talking about this before the announcement, but we were primarily talking about what we can do to return to a pre-pandemic level of spending, which is another huge problem we have, going from $4.4 trillion to $7.3 trillion in just the last 6 years.
So, but can I just ask, Gunnerstone, to the question of trade policy? Congress is supposed to play a role in that. Do you feel that the president is listening to you? Do you feel that you've had any input into this program before he rolled it out?
Well, Congress is willingly granted a lot of its constitutional authority to the president, and part of it on trade. And he's using that authority.
So, President Trump ran on immigration and inflation. Those were kind of the primary drivers of his campaign. If this does raise cost, how do you explain that to people who voted for him? Because they thought he would lower their cost of living.
Well, I think he's very aware of that. He also ran saying that tariff is the most beautiful word in the English language. So, you know, this again, this should not be unexpected. This is a core belief of his, and we're going to find out to what extent he's right and many people are wrong. I really don't know. Right now, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. There's not much I can really do about it, but keep the administration aware of what reactions, you know, are and, you know, the impact it has on Wisconsin businesses and farmers.
And so, speaking of that, are you hearing from your constituents? How are they? What are they saying to you, and what are you saying to them?
Well, again, it's interesting. They're supportive of what President Trump's trying to accomplish, but yet they're concerned about the impact on their particular business. So everybody realizes this is a double-edged sword. That's very true. Some people know they're going to be impacted more than others. Some people are going to benefit from it. So it's a real mixed bag.
And so far, though, how are you explaining this to your constituents? Are you saying that you think the juice is going to be worth the squeeze in the long run? Or are you saying this is a moment of shared sacrifice? Or how are you talking about it with your constituents?
I'm telling them to keep me totally informed, and I'll keep the administration informed as well.
So before we let you go, what's the next step here? What are you going to be looking to? Or are there any particular data points before you feel like you need to speak up and say more? Or are you going to sort of go back to the president and try to get him to renegotiate? Is there some particular data point you're looking at?
Well, we'll take a look at exactly what investment is being pledged. Right now it's $5 to $6 trillion. We'll see how other nations react. And some are already decreasing, if not eliminating, their tariffs. So to a certain extent, that right now there's some positive impacts of this. Although, obviously, what's happening to the stock market's not positive.
That is U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. He's a Republican from Wisconsin. Senator Johnson, thanks so much for your time. I do hope we'll talk again.
Have a great day.
Country music superstar Morgan Wallen is releasing a new album next month. To call it highly anticipated doesn't do it justice. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music reports.
Every now and then I go get a taste, but I never fall in love, baby, just in case, just in case.
Morgan Wallen's latest single, Just In Case, debuts at number 4 on Billboard's main pop chart this week. That means he's done something no one has ever done before. But first, a quick explainer. There are many effective ways to roll out a new album. The traditional approach is to make an announcement months in advance, then allow new information and advanced singles to trickle out in the run-up to the release date. One new-school streaming-era approach has major stars dropping albums with little to no advance notice. There are risks and rewards to both approaches, but most labels still like to work with a little bit of a runway. Well, Morgan Wallen's forthcoming album, I'm the Problem, drops May 16th, but the pre-release runway stretches all the way back to last summer.
Them ain't nothing but lies, 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 looking to my eyes, eyes.
This was the first teaser. The single Lies, Lies, Lies came out in July. It peaked at number 7. Then came another single last November. That debuted at number 1. Wallen dropped 2 singles in January. Both hit the top 10. And now with the debut of Just In Case, Wallen has charted 5 top 10 singles from an album that isn't even out yet. And he's the first artist ever to do so.
You hate the way you look at me. You halfway see yourself and it got me thinking. If I'm the problem, well, you might be the reason.
Prior to Wallen's feat, 2 artists have landed 4 top 10 singles in the run-up to an album's release, Post Malone and Taylor Swift. But Wallen stands alone, and he might not even be done yet. The album doesn't come out for another 6 weeks, and yet another of its songs, I'm a Little Crazy, debuts at number 17 on this week's chart. There's little question that I'm the Problem will be one of 2025's biggest albums. What remains to be seen is which Wallen song, if any, is able to break out as a dominant Song of the Summer style chart topper. He's already bought 6 tickets for this year's sweepstakes. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
Yeah, the only thing keeping these tracks on the train.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. Bury me where the wind
on the next Fresh Air, songwriter, singer, and guitarist Jason Isbell, who is described in Variety as the poet laureate of American rock. He won 9 Americana Music Awards and 6 Grammys. His new solo album includes songs about the breakup of his marriage to singer-songwriter and violinist Amanda Shires. Join us.
See the windmills turn up 55. Still got so much.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. When school's out and parents need a break or cheap long-term babysitting, for generations, kids, especially city kids, have gone to spend time with relatives in the summer. What are those days like away from home? What happens, though, when they're young black boys who are allowed to roam and explore away from rules and routines, but also away from everything they know? Writer and MacArthur genius Kiese Lehman has some ideas. He has written a stunning new children's book called City Summer, Country Summer, and he's with us now in our studios in Washington to talk about his version of Endless Summer Days in the South. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Michelle. I'm happy to be here with you.
Why a children's book? I think people who know your work know that one of your most well-known books, Heavy, it's titled Heavy, can be a little heavy.
Right. You know, we talked about Heavy when it came out, and one of the things that you said when we talked about that book was, it's just hard in this book. And I wanted to create something that was softer and honest. You know, I think that book was about, like, the origins and the consequences of a lack of safety for children. And so I wanted to really, like, sit in what happens if we really explore a culture and a society and grandmothers that help create safeness in spite of the unsafety of the world.
So tell us about the characters and the storyline in City Summer, Country Summer.
Yeah, so there's this kid in New York who comes down from New York to visit his grandmother, and then there's other two kids who come from Jackson, Mississippi. And so for the kid from New York, it doesn't matter that those kids are from Jackson, which is a city, their country to him. And it doesn't matter for the country kids whether New York is actually from New York or from Rochester or from Albany.
Or New Rochelle.
Or New Rochelle, right? He's New York to them. And so I just wanted to also create a book that was about, like, the impaired of, like, black boy softness. I think people a lot of times talk about black boy joy, but I don't think we talk a lot about the importance of black boy touch, black boy play, and black boy experimentation. And I got lucky in that the artist Alexis Franklin came on to create, like, I think one of the most lush picture books I've ever seen. And we really wanted to get forest and gardens into this space, because in my childhood, those were spaces that were ironically, like, the most safe for us. Those forests and those gardens were where we learned how to touch, where we learned how to accept touch. And even though we didn't use these words, they're also where we learned how to accept love. And that's really what I just wanted to create.
Well, why don't you read us some?
Absolutely.
This is the point in the book where they've been together for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're in the woods for the first time, and I'll just start. New York wandered away from us and walked closer to the edge of the woods. You good? We asked. I'm ready to go home, he said. Something in those central Mississippi woods reminded New York of the language of home. Being reminded of home so far away from his newborn sister, Cece, so far away from the bodegas, the fire hydrants, and the city blocks, terrified or satisfied New York. Whether it was absolute fear or exquisite satisfaction, wandering through those cool spots in those Mississippi woods was too much for New York's body. We didn't speak this. New York didn't speak this. But our bodies knew.
That is lovely, and it's poignant, and it does so many things. Because one of the things that it made me think of is how, not just black boys, but maybe particularly black boys, we sometimes don't give them enough credit for having a depth of feeling.
That's true.
I mean, so much of the literature, it seems to me, around black boyhood is about being hard or
right,
being cool, but just the ordinary feeling of missing your baby sister.
Yeah.
And being homesick.
and being lost. And, you know, and I want to create art and read art where Black children are allowed to be lost, because being lost is a kind of experimentation. I just wanted to explore that sensibility of being somewhere new and missing somewhere old and longing for touch.
There's another passage I wanted you to read where you talk about that healing power. Would you read that for us, please?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So at this point, they've been looking for New York in the garden. They've been playing Marco Polo, and they can't find him.
Well, hold on, dude. People just, I don't know, does everybody know what Marco Polo is? It's like a game a lot of times you play in the,
right,
in the pool.
So when I came up north, I found out that people play Marco Polo in the pool because we played Marco Polo in the garden because we didn't have pools, right? And
okay.
So at this point, New York has found the boys, and the boys have found New York. In the middle of the garden, we felt a forceful wind getting closer to us. And when we turned around, New York tackled us and tumbled upon a row of my grandmama's butter beans. On the ground of that garden, covered in vegetables and dirt, coated in so much laughter, I want to say that the Mississippi and New York and our Black boy bodies were indistinguishable from each other. That would be a lie. We absolutely contrasted. But the sights, tastes, and smells of our contrast felt like safeness. Not safety. Safeness. And safeness sounded like love.
Do you want to say more about that? What is the difference between safeness and safety?
Yeah, for me, I think, you know, growing up in Mississippi, you know, my grandmother worked in a chicken plant factory. She grew up in 1929. She knew segregation in ways I would never knew. She knew unsafety. And I grew up in the 80s and 90s, which were sort of unsafe times for a lot of Black children. But even in those unsafe spaces and times, I think there was like a bodily, psychological, emotional feeling of safeness when I was in my grandmother's house and my grandmother's like touch when she could see me. And so I'm trying to encourage us to, one, realize that every child on this earth deserves safety. But also, I think as parental figures, there's like a psychological, physical, spiritual safeness that we have to ensure that I think our children have. And it's hard to do that when we don't have it ourselves.
And creating a sense that this is important, acknowledging
Absolutely.
That it's important. I'm feeling like this book isn't just about sort of calling out something that's wrong. This book is about celebrating what could be right.
I wish I had that sentence when we were putting the book out. But it is absolutely about celebrating something that can be right. And that's something that can be right. We have to remind ourselves it can be our bodies. I think a lot of us move through the space in the world. I did as a young Black boy, thinking that my body was necessarily unsafe because of the way adults treated me, the way police treated me. But I was never treated unsafe by my grandmother.
And I wonder if maybe in a way this book is meant to be healing for adults too.
Absolutely. You know, before kids can read letters, they can read faces. And so my hope is that, like, you know, people who read to not, you know, 5-year-olds or 4th graders can share those facial expressions with young people who, you know, are in need of safety, but who are also in need of seeing that their fathers and their mothers and their uncles and their aunties' faces contort with the kind of joy that I think only children's books can bring.
Cassie Lehman is the author of the new children's book, City Summer, Country Summer. Cassie Lehman, thank you so much for talking to
us. I'm so thankful to be here. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On President Trump's second day in office, Mari Stonick was told the government is shuttering all DEI offices and you're being put on leave.
I was incredibly shocked, and the first thing I said was, I'm not in a diversity, equity, and inclusion role.
Now Stonick and others are fighting back. I'm Ari Shapiro. That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Members of the U.S. Conference of Mayors are urging President Trump to reverse course on tariffs. As of today, they also include 25% levies on imports of cars and parts. The automotive industry is an important economic driver in Lansing, Michigan. Mayor Andy Shore fears Trump's sweeping tariffs will make vehicles made in his state too expensive for people to afford.
The hurt is going to be huge. You know, if it's billions of dollars to create a new auto plant or to build new manufacturing, we'd love to see it, but it doesn't guarantee it's going to happen. It just guarantees that prices are going to go up.
However, Trump argues the tariffs will level the playing field and boost domestic manufacturing. Yesterday, he announced elevated tariff rates on dozens of U.S. trading partners while imposing a 10% baseline tax on imports from all countries. Millions of people across a large swath of the central U.S. are in the path of dangerous storm conditions. There have been several reports of destructive tornadoes across portions of Oklahoma, Missouri, western Tennessee, and Kentucky. National Weather Service meteorologist Mark Chouinard speaks to historic rainfall and floods.
The flood risk is going to really start ramping up. So there's already been some flood impacts yesterday into last night across portions of Arkansas, western Tennessee, western Kentucky. And unfortunately, the heavy rain threat kind of continues through Saturday.
He's projecting 5 to 10 inches of rain on top of what has already fallen. From Washington, this is NPR. Myanmar's ruling military reports a death toll from last Friday's magnitude 7.7 earthquake exceeds 3,000. Monitoring developments from neighboring Thailand, where quake casualties are also reported, Michael Sullivan tells us the latest reaction from aid officials.
The military has declared a ceasefire that will last approximately 3 weeks in an effort to facilitate relief efforts, but warned it would respond accordingly if opposition forces launched attacks. The military had been carrying on with its campaign of airstrikes against rebel areas for several days following the quake. Several of the larger opposition groups announced their own ceasefires earlier this week. The World Health Organization is warning of the threat of cholera and other diseases in the worst-hit areas, with clean water, shelter, and food in short supply. And many who've either lost their homes or are worried about further quakes are sleeping outside with temperatures in excess of 100 degrees. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
Amazon's making a play for TikTok, another's Oracle, run by billionaire Trump supporter Larry Ellison. Citing national security concerns about China's influence, members of Congress passed a law to ban the hugely popular video sharing app in the U.S. unless its China-based parent company, ByteDance, sells its stake. Trump gave ByteDance until this Saturday. The Dow is down 1,400 points, more than 3%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fulton. Good morning. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced new details for his country's expanded incursion into Gaza. He says Israeli troops are taking over more land in the Palestinian territory. According to Gaza health officials, the Israeli military has killed more than 1,000 Palestinians since Israel ended a ceasefire with Hamas last month. To break down the details of this expanded incursion, we're joined by NPR's Hadil El-Shah in Tel Aviv. Good morning, Hadil.
Good morning.
So what is Israel saying it's going to do?
Well, all this week, Israel's defense minister has made it clear that Israeli troops are planning on seizing more and more land in Gaza and then adding it to a buffer zone with Israel. Then in a video statement last night, Netanyahu announced this third security corridor in Gaza. So in the past month, troops occupied a zone that cuts across Gaza's north. Troops already occupy a strip of land on Gaza's southern border with Egypt. So if this happens, it'll be an additional strip of land between those two, cutting across Gaza. Here's Netanyahu on his new plan. He said, we are cutting up the strip. We are increasing the pressure step by step so that Hamas returns the hostages. Also, Israel, we know, has been talking about permanently displacing Palestinians from Gaza.
And what does Israel want Hamas to agree to?
Well, Israel proposed last weekend for Hamas to release 11 hostages, including an American-Israeli dual national. That's about half of the living hostages still held in Gaza. It also wants Hamas to disarm. If Hamas agrees to this, Israel says there will be a 40-day ceasefire and then discussions to permanently end the war. But then yesterday, senior Hamas official Bassem Naim told NPR that Hamas is rejecting this proposal, calling it, quote, unacceptable. Hamas says it wants to go straight into talks about an end to the war. Israel says this is a strategy to twist Hamas's arm to agree to a deal that'll see more hostages come back home. But Israel's pressure campaign is working on a few different levels, you know, not just bisecting Gaza, but also ordering Palestinians to leave their shelters and blocking all aid. It's been blocked for a month now.
So a month without aid, what has that meant for Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, first, there's been this massive evacuation order this week to empty out 97% of the greater Rafah area in the south. The UN says now 100,000 Palestinians there are displaced. Muhammad Abdullah is one of them. You know, she said, we have to count our daughters when we move. Are there three, four, or five? Is one of them missing? Did we lose a girl on the way? And then just today, another evacuation order was announced around Gaza City in the north. And then there's the aid. This has been the longest time Israel has blocked all aid into Gaza since the beginning of the war. That means no food, no medical supplies, no fuel that's needed to power things like health facilities. So Israel says there was a surge of aid during the first phase of the ceasefire. So Gaza still has enough food. But then aid groups are saying food is quickly running out. The World Food Program shut down all of its 25 bakeries in Gaza because they say they've run out of flour and fuel. It told us it only has 2 weeks' worth of food supplies. It's distributing them to charity kitchens, and most Palestinians depend on those kitchens for their one meal a day.
NPR's Hadil El Shalchi. Thank you, Hadil.
You're welcome.
There are different ways countries can project power around the world. One is with military strength. Another way has been targeted by the Trump administration's budget cuts. NPR's Emily Fang reports on what some of these projects and programs have delivered over the decades.
After World War II, the U.S. started building what scholars now call soft power tools. Of particular interest was radio.
From the Fairland headquarters, December the 28th,
a medium so powerful in winning hearts and minds that just a few years earlier, the Nazis subsidized the production of cheap radio sets. And after the defeat of the Nazis, the Allies, led by the United States, broke up Germany's national radio system into regional broadcasters to limit the power of the microphone. But the U.S. simultaneously invested in building that power for itself.
She methoded it fascist.
In the 1950s, U.S. Congress authorized Radio Free Europe in Germany and later Radio Liberty to start beaming shortwave news reports into Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, including this broadcast in Romanian.
It was absolutely vital source of information to know what was going on in their own country.
This is Ronald Linden. He was a former research director at Radio Free Europe in 1989. From there, he witnessed the fall of the Berlin Wall that year, and then...
bang, down goes Czechoslovakia. And then they said, well, it'll never happen in East Germany. Bang. One after another, the regimes fell.
In the decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Radio Free Europe chronicled the rise of the European Union and democratic backsliding in Eastern Europe. But in March, President Trump ordered the agency, which oversees the outlet and other state outlets, dismantled, though Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is challenging its funding freeze in court. Carrie Lake, Trump's appointee to head that agency, has said Radio Free Europe is being infiltrated by, quote, spies and terrorist sympathizers putting out biased coverage. Lake has defended the administration's dismantling of what she calls a rotten agency in the press, including in a March interview with Newsmax.
The rot is so bad, it's like having a rotten fish and trying to find a little portion you can eat. It's unsalvageable right now. And so I agree with President Trump. Let's scale this thing down to the bare bones minimum.
Though it's not clear whether the broadcasters will be dismantled entirely or retooled. Her agency did not respond to a request for comment. The federal cost-cutting has also hit a bevy of research centers and scholarships like the Fulbright and think tanks like the Wilson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace, which bolster the U.S.'s foreign policy expertise. They are part of what makes the U.S. an intellectual powerhouse the world over. Here's Nicole Hemmer, a historian at Vanderbilt University, speaking about the Wilson Center's archives, which are now at risk.
The Cold War was kind of the foundational geopolitical reality for the United States for 40 years. And so these archives don't just help us understand the world, but they help us better understand our own history here in the United States.
And in turn, the U.S. built a deep pool of foreign leaders and academics who studied in the U.S. or grew up listening to American broadcasts.
That's the problem with the idea of soft power. It's very hard to quantify, but it was very real.
This is Derek Mitchell. When he was the U.S. ambassador to Myanmar, he frequently encountered foreign officials and scholars who had done programs with the U.S. Institute of Peace or received U.S. grants.
The best and brightest. And they had this image and admiration of the United States.
Mr. Johnny was hiding underneath the bed. Ah,
look of misery. Wherever I meet Johnny, people be sorry to see. The grave for Johnny and the gallows for me. Should never do a thing like that, to bite Papa Houdini in the back. But the judge and the jurors bound to see my face, for this thing going to end in a murder case. Oh, look at misery, wherever I meet Johnny. People be sorry to see. The grave for Johnny and the gallows for me.
Yeah, something went goopy with the can set that's on that we always hear in the morning. So I put some regular music on. Let's go with some Glenn Miller for a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you.